The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to today's program. In about 20 minutes, we'll be going to Dr. Lynn Saputo. He's a board-certified physician in internal medicine. He also is an academic, graduated from Duke University Medical School. And we're going to talk about the modern pharmaceutical and medical paradigm, and how, as long as we continue to believe that the medical paradigm is important, we continue then not to benefit as individuals or as a society. And yet both left and right on this spectrum, Democrats and Republicans receive money from Big Pharma and are supported by the medical community, and as a result, the patients suffer. So we're going to get into this in some depth. A special commentary from Chris Hedges on The Corporate State Wins Again from TruthDig.com. Also, for those of you who ask me, where are the most dangerous places in America to live as far as the contamination of the water because of shale gas fracking? I'll give you those. I've gone up. I put together a whole map of the United States to show you the most vulnerable areas, because otherwise you wouldn't know when looking at property. You is 100 miles away. Is there a fracking going on that could pollute this particular piece of property? So have a lot to share with you, plus something from NASA that is of great concern that you haven't heard about, and I'll share it with you. A warning on a solar superstorm next year, and why we should be very concerned. This comes from NASA, and I'll tell you about that. Let's begin with the latest on health and healing. If you have any young person who's overweight, you put them at greater risk of later having diabetes, heart disease, cancer, depression. One of the reasons that they're overweight is that they're deficient in various nutrients essential to health, but also deficient in vitamin D. A new study at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Rhode Island found that most overweight adolescents are lacking vitamin D, and therefore they should be getting the vitamin D each day. It makes all the difference in the world, and that can also help them with some of the problems they would otherwise have when they're overweight. So they shouldn't be overweight to begin with, but then if they're overweight and then suffering from nutrient deficiencies, they're at far greater risk of diabetes and heart disease. So let's make sure that they are not overweight, and we can prevent that, and we can help them if they are. Now, one of the things that you see in the tropics is you see berries. Frequently, these berries don't look like or even taste like the berries we have here, even if they're similar. For example, when I was in Sweden and Switzerland in the summertime, and they have a relatively short summer, I saw tiny little berries, and the Ralph Nader of Sweden, who I was filming at the time, said, Ola Dereker, said, oh, yeah, these are our strawberries. They were very sweet, but very, very small. They were about the size of a pea, you know, that you would use in a stew. Start considering tropical blueberries. And this is from the American Chemical Society. And this was published in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. And it says this: the first analysis of the healthy antioxidant content of blueberries that grow wild in Mexico, Central, and South America concluded some of these fruits have even more healthful antioxidant than blueberries in the United States. These extreme superfruits could provide even more protection against heart disease, cancer, and other conditions. And Edward Kelney and colleagues note that although there are over 600 species of blueberries and blueberry-like fruits growing in Mexico, Central and South America, the so-called neotropics, they haven't really done a whole lot of research on them. But now they have, and they're very highly concentrated in antioxidants. And, of course, in these countries, it's very common to find them growing everywhere. They grow wild. So we should hopefully see that some of the small farmers and will start to grow these and dry them, and hopefully on small farms and collectives, work these together and send them to other countries or into the United States, because there's a big market for them, and they grow wild. So if you have a chance to eat wild blueberries, especially tropical blueberries, do so. They have more good nutrients than those grown in the United States. I'm a big promoter of curcumin. I believe it's one of those nutrients we should be taking on a daily basis. If you have cancer, I would recommend you start at 5,000 milligrams and go up probably to 8 or 9,000 from there. The average person, when they do get curcumin, generally it's in the form of curries, and it comes through its main spice, which is turmeric. But the active ingredient in turmeric, which is the principal coloring agent in curry, is curcumin. Here's the latest on this, and this was published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry. It says that curcumin naturally fights cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's and obesity. It's certainly a supernutrient. It can dramatically lower the risk of cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's, and it also can affect how the body stores fat and alter your metabolism so you're less likely to become overweight. It's a natural polyphenol, and we need it because it can turn off inflammation in the brain, in the heart, and in the musculature. It's a multi-winning curcuminoid. I would put it in the top five of all the different things I would suggest someone take if they have any form of inflammation, and everyone has inflammation. Maybe start at 500 milligrams. It's been shown to fight cancer. It helps to restore the immune system, especially those who've had a weakened immune system because of being environmentally sensitive or having a poor diet. And it increases, for all those of you who know anyone with AIDS and who have low CD4 counts, I have seen so many people that I work with AIDS-defining illnesses increase their CD4 count when given curcumin. And the science shows that it increases both CD4 and CD8 counts. And for that, I'm suggesting 4 to 5,000 milligrams a day. And also, curcumin increases the production of proteins which are needed for immune cell proliferation while reducing the development of proteins which destroy immune cells. And it can also help if you have a problem having too much fat in the system, which can clog your arteries. So put curcumin up there on your list of nutrients to make sure that you get on a daily basis. It could literally, in my opinion, save some people's lives. And also, I'm concerned that 10 million American women are now, once again, taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy to turn off hot flashes and to prevent osteoporosis. Much easier to prevent osteoporosis simply by having a diet rich in greens, because that will certainly help you, like collard greens and kale and sea vegetables. In fact, sea vegetables like wakame and kombu have 10 times more calcium by dry weight than does dairy. So you're getting better calcium, and you're also getting iodine, which helps the thyroid gland. And then add in maybe 5 milligrams of boron, maybe 5 to 10 milligrams of manganese, and then calcium and magnesium at about 500 to 1,000 milligrams, some citrate, and then vitamin K2 and vitamin D, and you're on your way to having really strong, healthy bones, which means then your immune system will be stronger, because a lot of your immune system is made in your bone marrow. Now, when you take synthetic hormone replacement therapy, you increase your risk of breast cancer, heart attack, stroke, dementia, and now colorectal cancer. And here's the latest study on this. It showed that breast cancer rates fell when women began not to take synthetic hormone replacement therapy. This is from Reuters, and I'll quote this. It says, 400,000 women die from breast cancer globally each year. Breast cancer rates among postmenopausal women dropped nearly 10% after news of a big study that found taking hormone replacement therapy could increase breast cancer risk. The decline coincided with a sharp decline in the use of the drug after publication of the Women's Health Initiative study, which found an increased risk of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, strokes, and other problems. Before 2002, doctors widely prescribed hormone replacement therapy to lower the risk of heart disease, and which now has shown to go up sharply after menopause. But they were making $1 billion a year off the drug. And so women got concerned, women stopped using it, and guess what? The rate of breast cancer went down. And that's good news. So for those who want to take credit for, gee whiz, look, the rate of breast cancer went down, not because of any drug they took. To the contrary, it's when they stopped taking the drug, synthetic hormone replacement therapy like Premarin, that the breast cancer incident had a sharp decline. And finally, lycopene-rich tomato paste helps your skin from within. This is from the British Journal of Dermatology, and it found that daily consuming tomatoes or tomato sauces or tomato paste reduce reddening of the skin after exposure to ultraviolet light, and therefore will protect your skin. And it protects the mitochondrial DNA, and that's a reliable marker of UV ray exposure. So, quote, this study supports previous epidemiological animal and human data reporting protective effects of lycopene and indicates that this agent also protects against UVR-induced tissue damage. And that was from the University of Manchester and Newcastle University. So drink your tomato juice, eat your tomato sauces, have tomato soup, because it's all good for you, and it's going to protect your skin and make it healthier. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. My guest in a few moments, Dr. Lynn Saputo, is online. We have a lot to share with our audience concerning our state of health care in the United States today. A few quick updates. Here are the areas of the United States that have the highest amount of exploration for gas from the shale gas and the hydrofracking, where millions of pounds of chemicals are added into a well with a great deal of water. And that ends up causing problems. It pollutes the water, pollutes the aquifer. The Marcellus whole area, that would be New York, Pennsylvania, up through and also some of New Jersey, that's a bad area. So you, if you're going to buy any property anywhere up there, you first have to make sure that you find out where are the wells, because one single gas well that is hydrofracked can leach pollutants as far away as 200 miles. And if it gets into that and into those aquifer systems. Also bad would be down in Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, also Arkansas, up in Oklahoma, out in Nevada and Wyoming, and in southern, western, and northeastern Texas. Those are the places that have a lot going on. A lot of states don't have any of it, so there are a lot of good places, but those are not. At least be careful. Now from our environmental segment, and this is a piece that really concerns me. It's from helium.com, and it says the following, quote, "Could a superstorm generated by the sun destroy civilization as we know it? No less than NASA thinks it is a distinct possibility. In a remarkable move, the normally conservative U.S. space agency has taken the extraordinary step of warning the world. The headlines reverberating around the world speak volumes. Quote, leaks discovered in Earth's magnetic field. Solar storms could wreak havoc." And so what this means is that it could adversely affect the solar storms, could adversely affect the national power grids, and could overheat, and everything from air travel could be severely disrupted, while electronic items, navigational devices, and major satellites would simply stop working after the sun reaches its maximum power. Now, experts on the sun are very concerned as they see the sun awakening from its unusually long slumber with a violence unseen for generations. That violence could be in the form of mammoth magnetic storms. And those storms hitting the Earth will be like a giant fist slamming into the fragile electronic technology that runs the world. By the way, hurricanes, earthquakes, and tsunamis would pale by comparison. Quote, "We know it is coming, but we don't know how bad it's going to be," said Dr. Richard Fisher, director of NASA's Heliophysics Division. And he said in an interview with the Daily Telegraph, quote, "It will disrupt communication devices such as satellites and car navigational and air travel and the banking system, our computers, everything that is electronic. It will cause major problems." Now, this doesn't mean that it's a doomsday scenario, but it does mean that we had better pay some attention. And even the National Academy of Science issued a report, quote, "Severe space weather events, societal and economic impacts." And the report outlined in excruciating detail the potential, the adverse capacity of a storm like this on our society. And so I would suggest that people pay some attention of how they can function in a society that is no longer able to live exclusively on the grid. And therefore, things such as air power, wind, solar, these are the things we should start looking at. And you're only going to see that in small communities. You won't see that in any large cities. And a commentary. I'm concerned. I'm very concerned. When did our democracy die? When did it irrevocably transform itself into a lifeless farce, an absurd political theater? When did the press and labor and universities and Democratic Party, which once made piecemeal and incremental reform possible, wither and atrophy? When did reform through electoral politics become a form of magical thinking? When did the dead hand of the corporate state become unassailable? The body politic is mortally wounded during the long, slow strangulation of ideas and priorities into the Red Scare and the Cold War. Its bastard child, the War on Terror, inherited the iconographic and language of permanent war and fear. The battle against internal and external enemies became the excuse to funnel trillions in taxpayer funds and government resources into the war industry, curtail civil liberties, and abandon social welfare. Skeptics, critics, and dissenters were ridiculed and ignored. The FBI, Homeland Security, and the CIA enforced ideological conformity. Debate over the expansion of empire became taboo. Secrecy, the anointing of specialized elites to run our affairs, and the steady intrusion of the state into the private lives of citizens conditioned us to totalitarian practices. Sheldon Wolin points out in Democracy Incorporated that this configuration of corporate power, which he calls inverted totalitarianism, is not like Mein Kampf or the Communist Manifesto, the result of premeditated plots. It grew, Wolin writes, from a set of effects produced by actions or practices undertaken in ignorance of their lasting consequences. Corporate capitalism, because it was trumpeted through the Cold War as a bulwark against communism, expanded with fewer and fewer governmental regulations and legal impediments. Capitalism was seen as the unalloyed good. It was not required to be socially responsible. Any impediment to its growth, whether in the form of trust-busting, union activity, or regulation, was condemned as a step toward socialism and capitulation. Every corporation is a despotic fiefdom, a mini-dictatorship, and by the end of the Walmarts, the ExxonMobils, the Goldman Sachs had grafted their totalitarian structures onto the state. The Cold War also bequeathed to us the species of the neoliberal. The neoliberal enthusiastically embraces national security as the highest good. The neoliberal, composed of the gullible and cynical careerist, parrots back the mantra of endless war and corporate capitalism as an inevitable form of human progress. Globalization, the neoliberal assures us, is the route to a worldwide utopia. Empire and war are vehicles for lofty human values. Greg Mortensen, the disgraced author of Three Cups of Tea, tapped into this formula. The deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocents in Iraq or Afghanistan are ignored or dismissed as the cost of progress. We are bringing democracy to Iraq and liberating and educating the women of Afghanistan and defying the evil clerics in Iran, ridding the world of terrorists and protecting Israel. Those who oppose us do not have legitimate grievances. They need to be educated. You know, it's a fantasy. But to name our own evil is to be banished. We continue to talk about personalities, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, although the heads of state or elected officials in Congress have become largely irrelevant. Lobbyists write the bills. Lobbyists get them passed. Lobbyists make sure you get the money to be elected, and lobbyists employ you when you get out of office. Those who hold actual power are the tiny elite who manage the corporations. J.P. Hacker and Paul Pearson, in their book Winner Take All Politics, point out that the share of national income of the top 0.1% of Americans, that's 0.1%, grew since 1974 from 2.7 to 12.3%. 1 in 6 American workers may be without a job. Some 40 million may live in poverty, with tens of millions or more living in a category called near poverty. 6 million people may be forced from their houses because of foreclosure and bank repossessions this year. But while the masses suffer, Goldman Sachs, one of the financial firms most responsible for the evaporation of $17 trillion in wages and savings and wealth of small investors and shareholders, is giddily handing out $17 billion in compensation to its managers, including $12 million to its CEO, Lloyd Blankfein. The massive redistribution of wealth, as Hacker and Pearson write, happened because lawmakers and public officials were, in essence, hired to permit it to happen. It was not a conspiracy. The process was transparent. It did not require the formation of a new political party or a new movement. It was the result of inertia by our political and intellectual class, which, in the face of expanding corporate power, found it personally profitable to facilitate it or look the other way. The armies of lobbyists who write the legislation, bankroll political campaigns, and disseminate propaganda have been able to short-circuit the electorate. Hacker and Pearson pinpoint the administration of Jimmy Carter as the start of our descent. But I think it began long before with Woodrow Wilson. The ideology of permanent war and the capacity by public relations to manufacture consent. Empires die over such long stretches of time that the exact moment when terminal decline becomes irreversible is probably impossible to document. That we are at the end, however, is beyond dispute. The rhetoric of the Democratic Party and the neoliberals sustains the illusion of participatory democracy. The Democrats and their liberal apologists offer minor palliatives in a failure pain language to mask the cruelty and goals of the corporate state. The reconfiguration of American society into a form of neo-feudalism will be cemented into place, whether it is delivered by Democrats who are pushing us there at 60 miles an hour or Republicans who are barreling towards it at 100 miles an hour. Wollin writes, by fostering an illusion among the powerless classes that it can make their interest a priority, the Democratic Party pacifies and thereby defines the style of an opposition party in an inverted totalitarian system, which means the Democrats are always able to offer up at least worst alternatives while, in fact, doing little or nothing to thwart the march towards corporate collectivism. The systems of information owned or dominated by corporations keep the public entranced with celebrity meltdowns, gossip, trivia, and entertainment. There are no national news or intellectual forums for genuine political discussion and debate. None. The talking heads on Fox, MSNBC, and CBS and CNN, well, they spin and riff on the same inane statements by Sarah Palin or Donald Trump. They give us lavish updates on the foibles of Mel Gibson or Charlie Sheen, and they provide venues for the powerful to speak directly to the masses. It is all burlesque. It is not that the public does not want a good health care system, programs that provide employment, quality public education, or an end to Wall Street's looting of the U.S. Treasury. Most polls suggest Americans do, but it has become impossible for most citizens to find out what is happening in the centers of power. Television news celebrates dutifully only what it is told and generally lies to the public. The viewer can believe whatever he or she wants to believe. Nothing is actually elucidated or explained. The sound bites by Republicans or Democrats are accepted at face value. And once the television lights are turned off, the politicians go back to the business of serving business. We live in a fragmented society. We are ignorant of what is being done to us. We are diverted by the absurd in political theater. We are afraid of terrorism, of losing our job, and carrying out acts of dissent. We are politically demobilized and paralyzed. We do not question the state, religion, a patriotic virtue, the war on terror, the military and security state. We are herded like sheep through airports by Homeland Security, and once we get through the metal detectors and body scanners, spontaneous applaud our men and women in uniform as we become more insecure and afraid. We become more anxious. We are driven by fiercer and fiercer competition. We yearn for stability and protection. This is the genius of all systems of totalitarianism. The citizen's highest hope finally becomes to be secure and left alone. Human history, rather than a chronicle of freedom and democracy, is characterized by ruthless domination. Our elites have done what all elites do. They have found sophisticated mechanisms to thwart popular aspiration, disenfranchise the working, and increasingly the middle class, keep us passive and make us serve their interest. The brief democratic opening in our society in the early 20th century, made possible by radical movements, unions, and vigorous press, has again been shut tight. We are mesmerized by political charades, cheap consumerism, and virtual hallucinations as we were ruthlessly stripped of power. In the end, the game is over. We lost. The corporate state will continue to advance until two-thirds of the nation is locked into a desperate permanent underclass. Most Americans will struggle to make a living while the blank fiends at Goldman Sachs and our political elites wallow in the decadence and greed of the Forbidden City in Versailles. These elites do not have a vision. They know only one word: more. They will continue to exploit the nation, the global economy, and the ecosystem, and they will use their money to hide in gated compounds when it all implodes. Do not expect them to take care of us when it starts to unravel. We will have to take care of ourselves. We will have to create small, monistic communities where we can sustain and feel ourselves, in our own completeness. We will be coming from a spiritual background. It will be up to us to keep alive the intellectual, the moral, and the cultural values the corporate state has attempted to snuff out. It is either that or become drones and serfs in a global corporate dystopia. It is not much of a choice, but it's all that we have. A special commentary from Chris Hedges on The Corporate State Wins Again from TruthDig.com. I'm Gary Knoll. This is Chris Hedges. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
There's a rose in a fisted blood.
Nice to have you with us. We're going to go to our guests in just a second, but I always promise people a chance to call in. I'm going to give you an 888 number. Please call in. I'll take a few calls now on this very topic. It is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. If you have a comment to make, please feel free now to call. Be happy to hear from you. Before we go to Lynn, let's go to Elizabeth in studio. And hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Good.
I have a question here. A lady from Brooklyn has called you Charlene. She came to see you about 5 months ago when after you'd lectured at the school that her child goes to. She'd watched the DVD Kiss Your Fat Goodbye, and she'd gone to see her doctor, and she's overweight. Her doctor told her that she would have multiple problems if she was overweight, that he really focused on high blood pressure, which is fine, but she's not feeling very good because she's overweight and she's had it, you know, verified by a doctor. And she'd like to know from you, what else can go wrong when a person is overweight?
Oh, well, if her doctor just said that it was just high blood pressure, that doctor should re-examine what happens when you're overweight. Just some things. First, you're going to have a loss of leptin sensitivity, and that induces hunger and inhibits release of stored fat from what are called adipocytes. Also, you're going to have a low adiponectin, and that increases fat storage, means you're going to have an inhibition of insulin sensitivity. You're also going to have an excess of glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase activity, and that means that the conversion of glucose from the food you eat and to stored fat, which are the triglycerides and adipocytes, and also you're going to have excess amylase activity, and that is that's not going to be good. You're going to have sugars overabsorbed and excess lipase activity, which enables too many dietary fats to be absorbed. You're also, when you're overweight, you're eating far too many calories, more than what the body needs for its normal metabolism and energy. You're going to have postprandial hypertriglyceridemia, which means you have too much fat remaining in the blood long after a meal, and that can cause a coagulation and aggregation, which means you can end up with a clot, and that can cause a stroke in the brain or an ischemic episode, a heart attack. And you could also have elevated C-reactive protein. That's the very first thing anyone who's overweight should have measured, is C-reactive protein, because that binds to leptin and neutralizes leptin's anti-obesity effects in the body and makes you more susceptible to heart attack or stroke. Also, you're going to have a diminishment of insulin sensitivity, and that's not good because that inhibits utilization of glucose in energy-producing cells and promotes excess fat storage. And then you can end up having serotonin deficits, and that's going to end up making you have that craving for sugar, craving for carbs. And in men, if you are overweight, you're going to end up frequently having a testosterone deficiency. And you can also have an estrogen-progesterone imbalance in women, and that is going to cause your fat to accumulate around your buttocks and hips and thighs. It also can contribute to a greater likelihood of thyroid deficiency. And also, you're going to have a higher blood sugar resting blood glucose level. and more insomnia, because when you're overweight, you end up having a greater insulin insensitivity, and that can cause your blood sugar to fluctuate, which means you're going to end up having sleep disruption. You're going to have a higher level of polycystic ovary syndrome, and overweight women are particularly prone to excess testosterone blood vessels and insulin resistance and ovarian cyst. You're going to have too much cortisol if you're overweight, and that can adversely affect visceral obesity, but also can make you more susceptible to a heart attack. And so those are just, you know, some of the things that go on when a body's overweight. So this whole idea that somehow we don't have to worry, oh, you're okay, you're just overweight. If you're overweight at all, you have anywhere from 15 to 30 different things that can go wrong in your body. So best that they get the weight off in a healthy way. Okay, thank you. Let's say hello to Tom from New Jersey. Tom?
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I would like to address the issue of our overpowered police state that we have, and the fact that, you know, the real ID thing, you know, with driving, where they scan you and look up all your personal information, your social security number, your bank information, everything right there with onboard computerized equipment on their overpriced cop mobiles.
I wouldn't stop there. If you're going to look at the problem, pull back and do it objectively. Look at how many of our rights we no longer have today.
Yes.
Because we have allowed both Democrats and Republicans to go along with the idea that corporate America wants to make profits by getting into the game of the national security state.
And all the associated paraphernalia.
And you frequently have as many as 15 separate corporations doing the same identical work, paid enormous amounts of money, frequently in no-bid contracts, and then once they are in business, it's almost impossible to get them out. They just keep making the money, they keep getting refunded, but you have to take it back to the lobbyist who caused this, and then the former generals, the former people within police organizations in L.A. and New York and Homeland Security. All of these individuals generally work for major security firms, and they have access, because they're former positions of power. Legislators do the same thing. Tom DeLay did the same thing. And then they can walk right into someone's office and say, give me this amount of money, and I will get you what you want. You want a contract? You want something deregulated? I will help write the actual legislation. I have these contacts. We can get this done. You have over 45,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. You have at least that amount of consultants in Washington. And so when you look at how many people are approaching members of Congress, then you see the same thing at the state level, and you see the same thing at the local level, then don't concern yourself with one police officer pulling someone over and then scanning in all the information they want about that person, even with the person not knowing what is being scanned or what use it would have. Look at the entire system and how it got that way. The only way to change this is to ban all lobbying, to have no private funding for any election at any level, to have all elections done by lottery, and to have all public funding. All election cycles can only last 3 months. Everyone, therefore, has an equal chance to present their information and their ideas on all common themes, and to be asked the same questions and have then an opportunity to present their arguments. If we did it that way, then all the lobbyists would no longer be able to enter. It'd be against the law for anyone to lobby for anything except the individual to address their issues with their legislator, but no one else, no corporate interest, and no one on behalf of corporate interest. So I'm looking at the bigger picture, not just individual grievances, because there are hundreds of thousands of individual grievances. The latest just this morning, when the State Department now wants new applicants for passports to have to list every employer ever had, from clear back to when you first started to work. Now, who remembers the name and address and phone number and of your supervisors and your religious views? All this information, they're data mining, and it should be objected to, it should be fought, but it won't. And like all the other grievances against our rights. Thank you very much. Let's say hello now to my guest standing by, Lynn Saputo. I gave his bio earlier. He's a medical doctor, board certified in internal medicine. And he's very concerned about what's going on in the world today, especially in medicine. He is the author of several important works, including A Return to Healing. Nice to have you with us today, Lynn.
Gary, always a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Lynn, I'm going to ask you two questions. Take your time and really evolve them. I'm concerned that our educational system is broken completely. I won't go into all the reasons why today. But I'm also concerned that our medical educational system is broken. So from the very time that what might be otherwise an idealistic man or woman decides to become a doctor for all the right reasons, there is an indoctrination process that occurs. There is no real competition. There is no divergent opinions allowed. So by the time they finally get out of medical school and residency and internship and are able to take up their practice, it's very, very difficult for them to do what you and others have done, find the truth that they can use the best of what they've learned, but they have to learn a whole new part of medicine, complementary medicine, the real cause of disease, and the real way it should be treated. Yet there is no effort for this to happen. I want you to talk about first why bad medicine exists today and bring in education of doctors, and then why we only have about 5,000 doctors who could be called complementary holistic out of over 900,000 physicians. That's under 0.5%.
Okay, those are great questions. Well, we practice bad medicine because that's what we're taught. And if you trace the dollars, you follow the dollars, you'll know why the system's like it is. We don't live in a democracy anymore. We live in an economy. And so the basis for how we operate has to do with following the dollars, seeing who's getting what are the conflicts of interest, why are people in power. And when you look at the medical system, it's big pharma that is basically running the system. They've got the big dollars. They are very generously, in quotes, offering their control and their money. They go together to medical centers to do research, to provide educational conferences, to basically brainwash people who are learning medicine, what to learn. And we have basically gotten away from a healing system and gotten into one that's mechanized into one size fits all, where we're using drugs and surgeries and technologies as our primary approach. We've forgotten about what happens in a healing setting, where you're listening and caring, and you're allowing the patient to have time to be able to tell you what's wrong with them, and if you wait long enough, actually to hear the solutions, because people know that. But we don't look at it that way. We look at it a very mechanistic way, and we're trying to find a drug for a problem. It's almost like a game. Here are your symptoms. Here are the drugs that treat those symptoms. Match them up, and that's what you're taught for the most part. Now, there's a lot of fluff that doesn't speak that way, that says, we do listen to our patients, we do care about them, we're interested in their psycho-spiritual essence, and we should pay attention to that, but you don't get reimbursed for that. The HMOs aren't going to allow you to spend time doing that. If you spend more than the allotted time, you're basically out of there in no time. So what we have is a system that is controlled by the money that's in the hands of Big Pharma. And even research is oriented that way. You know, the research that we do, $90 billion a year is paid for by the pharmaceutical industry and our National Institutes of Health, which pays for our government-sponsored research, is only 30. So there's three times as much that's paid for by Big Pharma. And the results that you get, we know from studies that have been done that look at this, you can't trust the results. When the Office of Technology Assessment looked at this issue in 1978, they came out with a statement that said that the amount of good, solid research that's published in our major medical journals is shockingly low. And I know when I ask this question to my colleagues, which I do on occasion when I give a talk at Grand Rounds to my colleagues, I'll ask them that question, and most of them are saying, 90% of it's good, or 95%, some think 99%. And then the first thing I do is say, don't shoot the messenger, because the answer is just the reverse of what you think, according to these people. It's 1%. Now, that is almost unbelievable. And when I first heard that statistic, it shocked me too. But that's why our system is broken, is because it's based on economics. It's based on return on investment. It's based on where does the money come from? Where does it go? Because that's the primary interest we have. That's why I say we're no longer a democracy. We are an economy. And this started long, long before people think. I mean, when we broke from Europe and came to this country, it was for religious and for economic freedom, and to be able to do things the way we want. And so we started the pendulum that was moving in the direction of, oh, I can have my own business, I can control my own outcome, I don't have to worry about the king or who's ever telling me what to do, I can practice religion the way I want. And what's happened? That pendulum's still going. We've gotten into an economic system that is running now the world, and we've bought into it. So we've become capitalists. We're narcissistic and self-centered. We've forgotten about community. We've forgotten about caring and loving. We're into power and control. And like you said, the lobbyists are running the country.
Good. I appreciate that answer. Now let's take a little further. Clearly, we cannot have any substantial change in our healthcare system if there are fundamental flaws in the system as it stands.
Correct.
Critique the medical model, besides based on big pharma industry.
Yeah.
It's also based upon feed and greed, and I see very little compassion and love in our medicine any longer. So unless this changes, I don't believe that we can expect any fundamental reform of our national health care and delivery system, none of which was discussed at all by those people writing the health care bill. So take us through that, please.
Yeah, you're totally right. We don't, first of all, have a health care system. We have a disease care system. We are not interested in helping people to find out what the cause of their illness is. We're more interested in supporting the system the way it is. And until we evolve to a higher level of consciousness and we're interested in supporting wellness and prevention using lifestyle measures and natural approaches as our first approach, we will continue to do exactly what we are, which is rearrange the chairs on the deck of the Titanic as it's going down big time, which it is. And I agree with you. There was no health care reform that I could see at all. A few pittances talking about, yes, we need to do something about lifestyle measures. We need diet and exercise and stress reduction. And Michelle Obama's talking about it, and I applaud that. But in actuality, we don't run the country. The lobbyists do. The corporations do. And they're interested in what? Return on investment. They're not interested in your being healthy. They're interested in your being sick, because that's where the money is. So you won't see a shift in what's happening with things being the way they were, the way they are. It won't be until we do what Einstein said, which is you cannot solve a problem at the same level at which it was created. You must do something to evolve to a higher level of consciousness and change your values. And when you change your values, if you will change them to loving and caring and community and connection from the narcissistic, self-centered, money-mongering approach that we have, it's hopeless. We, the masses, have gone along with that. And I think it's a big mistake to fight it. I think there's a necessary part that requires opposing it. I really applaud the work you've done in New York, particularly the stuff you did on swine flu vaccine, which I wrote a paper on myself. It was just like what you said, as it turned out. We have to find a way to peacefully change things by being the change we want to see. We need to evolve into people who care about our neighbors, who want to do the right thing, who are interested in supporting community, who want to be loving and listening and caring to our friends and neighbors. We want to live in a community that actually works. That's what's required. That's why I say evolution, not revolution.
Okay, but Lynn, modern medicine is at war with nature.
I understand that. It's a big mistake. It needs to be changed. It's a huge error. Mother Nature has always got the best answers for us.
Also,
all we have to do is listen.
Look at the AMA and look at the FDA. They're flawed ethics in both of these. Discuss
Absolutely.
That. And also, being a doctor is really to learn to become increasingly more human and loving.
Yes.
And
yes.
Humility should be a pinnacle of quality of excellence in medicine.
Absolutely.
And you got to remove fear from medicine, the fear of death, and replace it with inspirational education of patients to make the necessary life changes and to take their own health in their hands.
So
and yet,
right.
Hospitals reject science of,
yes.
of wholesome clinical nutrition.
Yeah.
And I find very little in medicine today that's actually scientific. So go through these, please.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There isn't science in medicine that's solid science. The almighty dollar is running things. If we're interested in making changes, we have to evolve. And this is what you're talking about. Our doctors aren't trained to be healers. They're trained to be mechanics, for the most part, that do the things that the government says you can do. The FDA supports the approach that's where the money is from Big Pharma. The CDC might as well not even be there. I mean, they're doing so many silly things, it's a joke. There's a revolving door between them and the pharmaceutical industry. I'm in total alignment with you that we have a system that's broken, that is not repairable, that requires a higher level of consciousness to live in community that's based on love and caring. We should be, as a healer, we should be supporting and not even charging for health care. It should be something we want to give. And that's why I say we can't go and continue to revolve around revolution after revolution, because what happens is you have one government that's corrupt running the country, the people revolt, and then we have another government that takes its place and does the same thing because there's been no evolution, and it continues and perpetuates itself.
Len, we have about four minutes left.
Okay.
I'm very concerned of how this health care reform bill was written, who was behind
yes.
it. It was a
yes.
fraud.
Yes.
How the Democrats could apologize for it and say, oh, it's better than nothing. It's not.
It's worse.
And the insurance system and the pharmaceutical said that there's a pill for every problem. There's nothing about prevention in here. There's nothing about preventing deaths. There's nothing about helping a person get better treatment if you have a problem. Talk to me about, in this audience, about what you would do to change the health care bill and the health care proposals we now have.
I'd shift it totally from a sick care system to a health care system, true health care. And what we would do is we would encourage healthy lifestyle. We talk about diet and exercise, stress reduction, sleep, weight, and meaningful purpose in life. I would talk about community and how we build that. I would have programs at every level of education that support lifestyle. I would teach our children through an educational program at every level of every school how to do that. I would also do that from the grassroots level as well as from the national level. I would throw out the whole system the way it is now and hold it in reserve for when a smart wellness programs don't work. Those would be simple things to do. I would get rid of direct-to-consumer ads. I would make sure that we weren't allowing people to be subsidized to make high-fructose corn syrup. I mean, there's such a huge list of things there that are being done that are absolutely antithetical to a system that is promoting wellness and prevention. But you've got to look back at how we live our lives and how we've evolved to where we are. And I still say the answer to that is not revolution, it's evolution. And that can be done as a movement. It can be done much like Gandhi did. And I think that takes an awareness, and people are waking up. And we're outraged. No question, we're outraged, but that's insufficient. That just brings us to an awareness level that we need to do something different. And we must. And that's why I wrote this book that talks about all the aspects of what's wrong with the healthcare system from the point of education, medical research, the FDA, the CDC, Big Pharma, the insurance industry, and the corporate democracy in Congress that's been bought by lobbyists. Those are the real answers, Gary.
Good for you. Len, we're running short on time here. Len Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O, medical doctor. His website is alternativemedicine.com.
Actually, it's a new one, Gary. It's called drsaputo.com now. And
okay.
It's amazing. It's got 2,000 audio and video pieces on it that are organized into surveys where I'm talking to you personally about your healthcare issues.
Oh, good. And the book is A Return to Healing. By the way, if you have a chance tomorrow, listen in. I'll be breaking some new news that will challenge the existing AIDS paradigm with some
Excellent.
Incredible scientists who are making some major discoveries that support what we've been saying all along. They've been on the wrong part of the cause and the treatment, and We will share that with our audience. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Gary, thanks so much. It's always a privilege.
Lynn Saputo. Now, tomorrow I have some very important guests coming up, and within the next 4 to 6 weeks, I'll be doing a 5 one-hour part series, a special in-depth original investigative reporting series entitled In the Name of Freedom and Democracy, and how we have justified to the world, to our own citizens, intervening in over 100 different countries, body politic, how we've caused assassinations, and how when Bill O'Reilly and others say, oh, you know, we're the greatest country in the world, we've got to come to a reality at some point of what we really have become, what we have been, and if we're to really make authentic change and become a great country. Have a nice day, everyone.
And I say, oh no, in a lot of ways you're a lucky guy.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.
Dying, screaming, crying, and let me